From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, government reform groups raise alarm over the Governor's Moreland Act Commission. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, will share his thoughts on the latest news about the commission and will remember the state's fallen firefighters. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Recent news reports are portraying Governor Andrew Cuomo's Moreland Act Commission on Corruption as possibly going off the rails. As the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports, government reform groups say they're concerned and want some answers.
Governor Cuomo appointed the Moreland Act Commission at the close of a legislative session that saw numerous lawmakers arrested, indicted, and jailed for corruption, and with no agreement on any reform measures. Cuomo said at the time that he wanted wrongdoers punished, and commission co-chair, Syracuse area D.A. William Fitzpatrick, described how that would be accomplished.
We'll do what Deep Throat told Bob Woodward to do, follow the money.
But several published reports in recent days raise questions about the independence of the commission and whether it is shielding its creator, Governor Cuomo, from scrutiny. The New York Daily News reports that Cuomo's aides suppressed subpoenas to the state Democratic Party and others, including the Real Estate Board of New York, that might result in a probe of campaign donations to the governor. But the campaign finance accounts of state senators, Republicans, and Democrats have been subpoenaed. In addition, the New York Times reports that commission chairs meet weekly with the governor's staff. Richard Brodsky, former state assemblyman and now a fellow at the Demos think tank in NYU's Wagner School, says the reports are disturbing. He says there are substantial questions that need answers.
If the governor's staff is directing subpoenas away from people who contributed to the governor and towards members of the legislature, then we have a serious problem.
Karen Scharf with Citizen Action is a major supporter of the commission, which she says has an historic opportunity to change Albany's pay-to-play culture. But she says she's also worried about what she's heard lately.
The rumors and the news reports are definitely very troubling. It makes me concerned that the commission may be starting to back off of their mission too quickly.
The reform group Common Cause sent a letter to Governor Cuomo and his top aides. It called the news reports disheartening and reminded the governor that the commission was created to restore faith in government, not confirm public cynicism. Common Cause's Susan Lerner says she still believes, though, that the commission can right itself and stick to its original mission.
I see this not as the beginning of the end, but rather a reinforcement of what the governor said when he set it up. That's an important distinction.
The New York Times also reports that Cuomo may be developing an exit strategy. It would include negotiating a deal on a reform package with the legislature. Scharf with Citizen Action says an agreement on comprehensive reform that includes matching donor public funding for candidates and strong enforcement of the campaign finance laws would be great, but she says she's not so sure that would actually happen. She predicts a weaker bill would likely result.
But an early agreement that backs off and comes to some kind of compromise because of the limits of what the legislature is already ready to agree to would be a real lost opportunity and a misdirection of the powers that they've got.
A spokeswoman for the commission points out that the law that created the Moreland Act back in 1917 requires that the commission report back to the governor and the attorney general once a week. Commission co-chair D.A. Fitzpatrick was not available for comment, but he said recently that any claims that the commission is not acting independently are categorically false. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, we just heard our Karen DeWitt reporting on the Moreland Act Commission and some of the troubling information that's coming out of various reports. You spoke with the Daily News' Ken Lovett this week, and we see an article now in the Times Union by Jim Odato that says, early exit possible for panel, discussing the possibility, apparently, of disbanding after recommending a constitutional amendment be offered to voters to allow public financing of state political campaigns.
Well, you know, that's just the way out of it. I think what's going on here is that Cuomo has gotten himself into a bit of trouble. And here's why. He came in, he said he was going to clean up Albany. He was going to do something his father hadn't been able to do, and he was going to bring people to heel. He made a series of mistakes. He said, for example, that he was not going to allow the legislature to redistrict itself, and then he went back on that. He did a group called J. Cope, and this was supposed to revolutionize governmental ethics. It didn't, and it's turned out to be a bit of a flop. And then finally, he now appoints a Moreland Act Commission, and now our friend Ken Lovett has discovered, along with the other reporters, that the governor has been reaching in, sending in plays to the so-called Independent Moreland Act Commission. For example, some of the real estate people who were going to get subpoenas aren't now, apparently, because the governor's people anyway. He said, don't do it. This is, of course, a very difficult situation for the governor, because the Moreland Act Commission was supposed to make things work. And so all I can say is that I suspect, although I have no way of proving it, that when the commission starts talking about decommissioning itself, it may be out of frustration that they're not being allowed to do their jobs.
And now we turn to casinos, where New Yorkers have to vote, and we're reading that it was the AG, Schneiderman, and Cuomo administration who were involved in crafting the language for the ballot question, which has a lawsuit against it already.
Well, the ballot question, as you know, has been framed in such a way as that a yes vote is encouraged by talking about all the good things that casino gambling would bring to New York State. There are those people who think that it should have been, do you want casinos or don't you? Instead, you have this clear attempt at manipulating the way people are voting. Well, in the beginning, it started to show that it was going to work, just the positive wording. But now the reporters and others are doing their thing, showing that this thing is meant to get people to vote positively. And there are a lot of people who don't like it. So again, there is a strategic issue here as to whether he knew what he was doing when he, I think, underestimated the people's intelligence.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Most people have heard of navigators for the new health insurance exchanges. They're the trained, impartial guides funded by the federal government to help people make more informed choices as they shop for policies. And then there are private insurance brokers. There's been less talk about it, but they too can help consumers sign up for plans. During the exchange's first days, Innovation Trail reporter Joanna Richards visited with both kinds of guides to New York's new health insurance marketplace to see how they were faring on the front lines of this major policy shift.
At the Foy Family Insurance Agency in downtown Watertown, Joe Foy is opening a letter. It's from an employee in a small business he's been working with. But instead of information like the worker's income, number of dependents, and so on, inside the envelope is a simple handwritten note.
I do not support Obamacare whatsoever. Signed, a defender of freedom.
Foy tapes the note up on a cabinet.
Funny thing is that the plan that we were doing this for is called the Freedom Plan. So this person saying a defender of freedom is kind of ironic.
Everyone in the office gets a chuckle out of the note.
Every employer that we deal with has a political opinion towards us, and they're actually, they don't know a whole lot. They just say what they've heard, and it gets a little frustrating because it's the law, and it's passed, and we just kind of like, you know, people to actually be informed.
The agency sees a business opportunity in the Affordable Care Act. Foy sits at a conference table in front of a big computer screen. Here, he and a client can look through the exchange website together. It's part of the agency's investment in making it in the new world of the individual health insurance mandate and the state exchange. On the exchange's second day, things are moving pretty slow.
This is about my fourth or fifth attempt trying to get on the New York State of Health website. But unfortunately, it's very slow, probably because there are quite a few people trying to get on. So curiosity killed the website.
That was last week. By Monday, a glitch was still keeping Foy off the site. But he said the customer service hotline was really helpful. He was told it would probably be a couple of weeks before he's able to gain access. Foy points out there's no reason for people to wait in front of a frozen computer screen. Shoppers have until December 15th to sign up for the earliest coverage, which begins January 1st. But Donna Hines understands the urgency many people feel as the exchange opens for business. She's the insurance coordinator for the North Country Prenatal Perinatal Council and a trained navigator. Hines has been working with people for years to help them access existing state insurance programs. But even with those programs, many fall through the cracks.
For years, we have witnessed firsthand people going without medical care because they couldn't afford the medical care. They couldn't afford the insurance premiums.
Many of those people are parents coming in to enroll their kids in the state children's health insurance program, but they themselves lack coverage. Hines says the council has been adding their names to a contact list for when the exchange is up and running. That list is more than 300 names long.
They're very anxious. They have medical needs, and they're very anxious to find out what's going to happen to them on January 1st, coverage-wise.
Even though brokers can see navigators as federally funded competition, Foy says the individual mandate for insurance opens a whole new market for his family's business. And in its own leap of faith in the new system, the Foy agency is planning to drop its group health insurance plan. Instead, the company will help employees pay for individual coverage through the exchange. In Watertown, I'm Joanna Richards for the Innovation Trail.
An environmental group in the Hudson Valley has put the New York State Thruway Authority on notice concerning two alleged violations during construction of the replacement Tappan Zee Bridge. One allegation involves monitoring an endangered fish species. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn with more.
Westchester County-based Riverkeeper recently filed a notice of intent to sue the State Thruway Authority, Tappan Zee Constructors, and one of the contractors under the Clean Water Act. Here's Riverkeeper's Hudson River Program Director, Philip Musikas.
We filed notices of intent to sue. That's not because we want to go and sue people or sue polluters or sue the state, but we do it because we want to make a formal record of the violations we've seen, and we want to work towards a resolution.
He says after dredging in the Hudson River for construction of the new bridge began August 1st, Riverkeeper observed the dredge crane operators raising the dredge bucket from the river and pausing, allowing large volumes of turbid water and sediment to drain directly into the river. The bucket was then directed to dump the material into a barge. He says the dredge crane should operate in a continuous motion between the river and the barge.
On the dredging issue that we identified, in fact, we have seen some improvement since we met with the Thruway Authority, since we went out to the site and actually did a site visit to watch the dredging.
He adds,
But it's important to note on that the requirements for how the dredging is done are a separate and independent requirement from the water quality requirements in the permit. It is true that there are separate water quality requirements and water quality monitoring, and those standards have been met so far. But the reason there's a specific requirement for how you use the dredge crane and how you move the bucket around above the water is to minimize all the sediment and turbidity going into the river and having local impacts at the point of dredging. And that is what we were concerned about.
A second alleged violation concerns an endangered fish species.
We had inquired about the status of the sturgeon monitoring, and they had told us that it was not complete. And we expressed our concern about that. They said they were working to complete it. But the bottom line here is that should have been done, essentially, that was supposed to be done 60 days after the permit went into effect, which should have been somewhere around the middle of May or the end of May. And it was required to have been in place and operational before they started dredging at all on August 1st, and it was not.
A spokesman for the New York State Thruway Authority referred comment to the State Department of Environmental Conservation. A statement from a DEC spokesman says, quote, Riverkeeper ignores the facts and fails to identify any violations of water quality. The Department of Environmental Conservation developed the conditions in its permit to be fully protective of the Hudson River, and the available data confirms that DEC's permit and monitoring program have been and will continue to be effective in protecting water quality, end quote. Again, here's Riverkeeper's Musikas.
We gave them an opportunity, and we gave them, frankly, over 6 weeks, once dredging started, to work with the DEC to get the system operational, and when we found out it wasn't, we thought it was best to make a formal record of that and to push them to get the sturgeon monitoring done as soon as possible.
A DEC spokesman says Riverkeeper was aware the issue was already being addressed. Musiga says he's looking into reports that 6 dead sturgeon have turned up over the past several months, some close to where the new bridge is being constructed on both the Rockland County side and Westchester side. He says there is no known link between the bridge's construction and the dead sturgeon.
We need to get to the bottom of why we seem to have higher numbers of sturgeon mortalities and figure out if it's at all connected to the bridge. And one critical step on that is having this monitoring system in place.
In March, the DEC reached an agreement with Riverkeeper and Scenic Hudson after lawyers from both environmental groups had said the terms of a revised draft environmental permit for construction of the bridge was too vague and weak to minimize construction impacts on the Hudson River. The resulting settlement agreement also gave the groups a seat at the table in monitoring the construction.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. More than 11,000 acres of Adirondack lands recently opened for recreational use. It's the first time the lands have been accessible to the public in over 100 years. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley.
Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that the land and waters of the Essex Chain of Lakes Tract in the central Adirondacks, obtained by the state from the Nature Conservancy, had opened. The land will be managed under an interim plan pending final classification by the Department of Environmental Conservation. Adirondack Wild Friends of the Forest Preserve partner Dan Plumley says for the time being, access is non-motorized.
Delighted that the lands are available. Of course, we're cautious and we're urging that the state, through the DEC, keep close track of those sensitive resources.
Plumley, who supports a wilderness classification, adds that the primary issue now is monitoring for overuse.
You know, it's kind of a test run to see the interest in the area, and I think it's going to be significant because it's gotten a lot of press. It's a new area that hasn't been opened up to the public for over a century, and it's quite enigmatic wilderness. It's quite special. It's a beautiful area to paddle. It's important to keep a watchful eye on it.
The lands were obtained from Finch Prine by the Nature Conservancy and then sold to New York State in 2012. Adirondack Nature Conservancy Executive Director Mike Carr agrees that pending classification of the lands, they must be carefully monitored.
The Essex Chain of Lakes is a very special place, a series of ponds mostly connected by water or very short carries. So it's somewhat delicate. So we'll just need to be very careful about overuse and careful management of access.
Carr describes the opening as the beginning of forever wild in the Essex Chain of Lakes area. He says he's not concerned that opening the lands prior to final classification will impact the process.
I think the DEC has done a nice job of balancing the public's rights with the need to get through the classification process. The connected series of ponds is very special. The other thing, it includes spectacular frontage on the Cedar River, really, truly wild, as well as 12 miles of the upper Hudson River from Newcomb South to the junction of the Indian. Really very, very exciting recreational opportunities on both the Hudson Rivers and the Cedar River. And frankly, I think some great hunting opportunities this fall as members of the public get out and begin to experience the place.
Opening the lands should be a boon for the towns and hamlets in the central Adirondacks, according to Town of Newcomb Supervisor George Cannon. He says the economy of 5 Adirondack towns depend on the final classification of the lands.
It remains to be seen what the economic benefit of this is going to be. If the classification becomes wilderness, the discussion of recreational opportunities is probably over in terms of economic benefits. If it's classified wild forest, which is what we're all hoping for, obviously, then when we get to the unit management planning process, the details of that will be worked out. So the first game plan is to get it classified as wild forest, and the second one will be the unit management process. If it goes wilderness, the ball game's over.
Recreational activities allowed on the newly opened lands include hiking, cross-country skiing, snowshoeing, hunting, and trapping, and fishing and paddling on the Essex Chain Lakes and other waters on the tract. Calls to the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation and the Adirondack Park Agency were not returned in time for this broadcast. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
The 16th annual New York State Fallen Firefighters Memorial Ceremony was held this week at the Empire State Plaza in Albany. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas was there and filed this report.
This year's ceremony honored 9 New York State firefighters who made the supreme sacrifice in the line of duty. Former firefighter Jerome Hauer is the commissioner of New York's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services.
The names on the wall behind me and the 9 firefighters we memorialize today are a stark reminder of the danger firefighters face every day. Each name on the wall is the name of a firefighter who went out the door and sadly did not return. They each accepted the dangers of their tasks and paid the ultimate sacrifice for their community, their fire department, and their fellow firefighters. We must also keep in mind that these brave souls represent even more than a firefighter. They represent a husband, a wife, a father, a mother, a son, a daughter, a brother, and a sister.
Lieutenant Governor Robert Duffy expressed concern about the risks firefighters are continually exposed to in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, including 2 from his area of the state.
I'm especially familiar with firefighters Ciparini and Kachuvka, who live in a community nearby where I'm from in Rochester. They're from the area of West Webster. And last Christmas Eve, those brave firefighters went to fight a fire and faced something they weren't familiar with. Here they go to put a fire out, and they are basically summarily executed and shot by a deranged gunman. And the whole landscape changed because firefighters are trained to go forward and put fires out, and that changed the whole thought process in terms of even adding on to the dangers that these brave men and women face every day.
There are nearly 2,400 names etched on the memorial wall, the earliest from a firefighter who died in the line of duty in 1811. Governor Andrew Cuomo marked the day by issuing 2 proclamations honoring the state's career and volunteer firefighters. The governor's proclamations mark October 8 as the annual Firefighter Appreciation Day and October 6 through 12 as New York's annual Fire Prevention Week.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1341. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.